Hey, Curiosity Builders, I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, storytellers, visionaries, and changemakers who are on a mission of chasing big ideas, telling epic stories, and leaving living legacies. Whether you're just starting out or have been at this creative and curious life for some time, I hope you'll learn something new in this podcast and find yourself inspired to break through the barriers that hold you back and keep you stuck from getting your work to work. What is good and worth preserving? This question has driven today's guests on Getting Work to Work at multiple levels. Lee Vinsel is an assistant professor of science, technology, and society at Virginia Tech. Andy Russell is a professor of history and dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at SUNY Polytechnic Institute. Together, they are co-directors of The Maintainers and co-authors of The Innovation Delusion, How Our Obsession with the New Has Disrupted the Work That Matters Most. In this conversation, Lee and Andy share about being historians of standards and their love for the ordinary. They also talk about how their fascination with standards led them to the topic of maintenance and the difference between true innovation versus innovation speak. Along the way, they share insights that we can all learn and apply to our lives, organizations, and society at large. They even share how they learned to work together and write as a team. Show notes and links to all the good stuff mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/451. Andy and Lee, welcome to Getting Work to Work. I'm really excited to talk with both of you today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Chris.
Yeah, absolutely. So I love to start this question with everyone that I talk with, and it's, what are you endlessly curious about? And let's go ahead and start with you, Andy.
We've got here at home, my wife and I have a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. So I am curious about what makes them tick and learn and not fight and eat, sleep, all of it.
I imagine they are endlessly curious at 3 and 5 as well.
You got that right.
Lee, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in the same boat as Andy, so I could give that answer. Another thing that Andy and I have been interested in for a long time is kind of the most boring aspects of technology. So we're both historians of standards. We both wrote, Andy wrote about internet standards and I wrote about automobile standards. Mm-hmm. So there's something about like the completely mundane and ordinary that's really fascinated Andy and I for a long time.
That is absolutely fascinating. I like what goes into researching standards. Like give us a small glimpse into that world.
Yeah. Andy, do you want to talk about like bells? Like, didn't they have like how to save people from manholes, like a standard for that or something?
Yeah, there's, it's a vast subject, but there's all sorts of methods for creating standards. Basically, a standard's a document and you want consensus. And you can come up, or organizations can come up with standards for any number of things from, manhole safety and manhole recovery, like Lee said, to I've seen some marijuana vaping standards being discussed in international standards bodies, to literal nuts and bolts, you name it.
Wow.
Right?
So as you're...
It's interesting.
It is interesting. And I imagine that as you dive into that, you start seeing all these different worlds present, whether it's, innovation, whether it's maintenance, and kind of the areas that you've been researching, that I'm aware of. Is that what got you interested in maintenance?
Yeah, kind of. I think it's what primed us to talk about maintenance. The Maintainers, we run a group called The Maintainers with our friend Jessica Meyerson. And it started off as a joke. And Walter Isaacson's book, The Innovators, How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution, had just come out. And Andy said we should answer it with a volume of our own, which would be called The Maintainers, How Bureaucrats, Standards Engineers, and Introverts Create Technologies That Kind of Work Most of the Time. And that idea just kind of took off on a life of its own. But I think, you know, the truth of the joke, we were kind of primed to see that because we had been working on, you know, these very ordinary processes that were involved in both innovation and maintenance, and, you know, knew that that was kind of where the most change kind of lay, you know, and not in like the shiny and new and apptastic and all those kind of things.
I love that you proposed an alternate to the innovators. And I love that sometimes an idea that we get that starts as a joke can turn into something that has impact and really lasts longer than the joke sometimes does.
Totally.
So one of the things that you've done is you've written a book called The Innovation Delusion. And just to kind of start wrapping our mind around this idea of maintenance, I thought I'd pose a question that I just loved from the book. And it's this: what is good and worth preserving?
Yeah, that's the big one. Andy, you want to give thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, we like that question because it's so personal. As we were going through the process of writing the book, we thought about that a lot. And I think about it all the time, especially in this last 6 months of extreme disruption with COVID and working from home, endless Zoom meetings for people like me. And so everyone, I think, has a sense of leaving the old normal behind. And hopefully we have some opportunities to make some choices about what our new normal looks like. And when we do that, I think the question that you quoted there should be really at the forefront of what we think about. What's really important to us, and how can we support that? And of course, in the book, the answer that we arrive at is that the new shiny thing that makes a lot of money and gets a lot of attention is often pretty superficial. And what we really want, what's most important, is something deeper, and something that we already know, and something that we need to maintain, whether it's friendships or going out to a bar, whatever it might be.
You know, the other side of it is that the way we've come to talk about innovation in the last 50 years really treats innovation almost as an end in itself. It's obviously not true when you think of it. You know, one example we've used for years now is that according to like strict definitions of innovation, like crack cocaine was a major innovation in the 1980s, you know, or like highly addictive opioids are, you know, innovations and things. So, but that's not how we use the word innovation. You know, what we really want is to achieve ends that we care about, you know. That's how innovation matters. And so part of what we're trying to do with this book is really trying to recenter the conversation around achieving those ends through both new things and changing processes, but also realizing that once we've established something, we're going to have to keep it going if we're going to continue to benefit from it. So it's that kind of balance we're looking for in the book.
Yeah. And that's really a good balance to have because, you know, you don't really think about it when you're buying the latest, greatest, shiny object. The whole idea of, I have to take care of this, I have to maintain it. Why does that stupid red circle with a number pop up on my updates? Why do I have to keep updating things? Why can't it just stay stable? But it's just like, that's not how it works. But this idea of technical debt, that just hit me hard. I'm like, wow, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, the debt metaphor is really powerful. And again, it's intuitive because we know it from personal finance, some of us more than others, I suppose. But notions of technical debt in software or infrastructural debt is a concept that we play with that's related to municipalities or states that build out highways or other infrastructure, but don't have any plans for paying for it, keeping it up and repairing it. It's really walking out on a ledge. Innovation really pushes us out on a ledge. And it's not to say we shouldn't go there, just we should be wise about what we're facing.
So Lee, I have to ask, what is the innovation delusion?
One distinction we like to play with is this distinction between what we call actual innovation and innovation speak. So actual innovation is the process of introducing new things or processes or business practices or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Innovation speak is the way we've come to talk and think about technological and business change over the last 50 years. And, you know, one analogy I like to make is that, you know, we know whether we're talking about science or economics, there's a big difference between the way the world is mm-hmm. and the way our theories are. There's a difference between our theories of the world and the world. Mm-hmm. And one part of what we're trying to show is that, you know, innovation speak does not necessarily produce more innovation. There's no evidence that it does that. So that's one problem. But also it kind of distracts us from other important things. And we've already been talking about some of those important things like maintenance mm-hmm. repair and just the work we do to keep things going. So that's the delusion, is that we've become kind of entranced with certain ways of talking and thinking, you know, whether it's agile, lean, disruption, you know, there's a whole smorgasbord of lingo around it that just doesn't always give us the, you know, the values and benefits that we're looking for.
Yeah, it's interesting because another way that you highlight just this delusion is the caste system as well. How, mm-hmm. you know, it separates people based upon what they're doing, whether they're quote unquote innovators or maintainers.
Yeah, that's right. And that's a really crucial point because it violates the sense of mobility that we're all taught to believe exists. But if you look at different occupations and you look at class mobility, and there's a lot of research about this, mobility tends to be really limited because of, you know, compensation, all sorts of really specific reasons, mostly to do with compensation and status, that actually prevent people from moving between one occupation and another. So again, like Lee was saying, that's the distance between the rhetoric of anyone can do anything and the reality of it being really, really difficult.
As you're talking about innovation speak, I kind of think about sometimes the feeling is just sprinkle a little bit of innovation on it and we'll just have these huge results, or kind of like we say, sprinkle a little creativity on what you're doing. And it's just like, you know, we treat it as if it's the process, not the ends.
Mm. Yeah, that sounds right to me.
We have how innovation delusion affects society in terms of, you know, the caste and how people are set apart. How else is it damaging our society?
So we can go back to that notion of debt. I mm-hmm. think that at an organizational level, you know, whether it's a company or a university or a nonprofit government, and at the level of states and municipalities, we're adopting things without thinking about that long-term cost of it, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've seen so many companies or in universities where they adopt some new system, it's supposed to change the world, and they don't realize what they're putting themselves on the hook for over the long term. So for instance, like Chuck Marone of Strongtown, who is one person we really look up to, he just talks about how, you know, U.S. infrastructure policy is set up so that the federal government will give municipalities, you know, free money effectively to build new structures. But then those municipalities are putting themselves on the hook for maintaining them over the long term. And they don't have the tax bases. When you get into the numbers, there's just not the money there to do that, mm-hmm. you know. So I think, you know, like a big theme in the book is like how to engender long-term thinking as leaders, as, you know, just people living our lives, and, you know, how to engender long-term thinking when there's so many incentives out there in the world that are pushing us towards short-term thinking.
Mm. Yeah, that notion of long-term thinking, I mean, that can be such a challenge for a lot of people, especially in the golden age of digital, where if you missed it, it's gone.
Mm. Yeah. And there's also, I mean, to bring it back to the personal again, we know from our own experience that looking after long-term considerations really does generate the best possible outcomes, whether it's health or whether it's, you know, saving for college or our kids' education. But I think we all struggle with the allure of the short term, whether it's, you know, that bag of M&Ms in my cupboard, or maybe I just want to go shopping today and not put that money in the bank after all. I think it's a really familiar tension. And it's one of the reasons why when we've in the book, when we map out the costs of the innovation delusion, it's such a vast subject. And so we decided to break it into yes. societal level problems at the organizational level, like in businesses or education, and then problems with individuals who, you know, are either told that they must be innovators or just forced into a situation where they can't even dedicate the appropriate resources to keeping up their own homes or vehicles or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm.
And I like how you frame it that way, because on one hand, when you read the book on the sections of infrastructure and society, I mean, those are just massive. I mean, you feel overwhelmed. At least I did. Yeah. When I'm reading that, I'm like, I feel overwhelmed with how do you actually respond to that? So I guess when you break it down to the individual level, it really helps to highlight the needed balance between that innovation, the true innovation that you speak of, and then maintenance, that long-term thinking.
I think it was, you know, one of the first chapters we started working on was, I think it's chapter 4 on the problems in infrastructure and what, you know, like this obsession with growth and building things up. We were writing about Chuck Marone, and we realized at some point that what Chuck was saying about like taking on so much debt, you know, we'll call it technological debt, whether it's infrastructure or whatever, software, and then being on the hook for it and not being able to deal with it, we realized at some point that it was like it was everywhere in what we were looking at, this kind of like tension between, you know, short-term incentives and the long-term needs. And so then it was just kind of like a cascading effect. You know, we could take it from this very big, you know, like, you know, I agree. I get depressed sometimes when I think about infrastructure policy, because, you know, infrastructure week has become like the punchline of a joke in the last, you know, under this administration. And, you know, but then we could take it all the way from there to like the most personal of like, you know, how you deal with your body and how you deal with your home and these things that everyone can identify with, even if it's at the level of a groan, you know.
Darn it, now I'm thinking about all the things that I have to do around the house.
Oh. Oh man, it's funny, you know, under the pandemic, Andy and I are both been getting work on our house, and every kind of like trades-based local business I've been working with to get things done are telling me they're totally overwhelmed by requests, because under the pandemic all of a sudden people are stuck at home. They're like, all right, I finally have to to deal with this, because it's in my face 24 hours a day, and I'm not going to Disney World, so there's a little bit more cash around, you know?
It's so amazing too, because I had to put in a proposal or get a proposal for a fence replacement, and they're like, we can't even give you the estimate for another month, and the work would be 6 to 8 weeks out. I'm like, can you put a fence up if the ground is frozen? They're right. Like, absolutely. I'm like, okay, wow. It sucks to work in that, I guess. But yeah, you know, yeah, it really speaks to that notion of just how much we don't think about maintenance. At least I don't.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I mean, you know, like, you know, there's a brief interview with a home inspector here in Blacksburg, mm-hmm. Virginia, who I hired to look at my house, and you know, I just talked to him about it because I told him I was writing this book when he was looking over the house, and he's like, "Oh my God, I have so many stories for you," and I think it's just, you know, I've even talked to experts in housing, you know, who study housing and housing policy here at Virginia Tech, and it's not just you, it's not just me. It is sadly endemic in the, you know, across our society, that people don't do the most basic home maintenance.
So Andy, from a general perspective, what is the maintenance mindset that you write about?
As far as the book goes, it's a big turning point, because we go to great lengths, as we've been discussing, talking about some of the problems that result from the innovation delusion. But we really wanted to write a book with a more optimistic tone, and not just complain about things and not just tear things down. And so The chapter on the maintenance mindset marks that turn in the book. And it's really our effort to say, you know, you can do this. you can take some steps, no matter if we're talking about yourself individually or your business or even the country, to actually put maintenance in the place that it deserves to be. And so the way we did that is to spell out three principles behind the maintenance mindset. And the first is to start with data. Right, the general recognition that maintenance sustains success. And you can define success however you want, whether it's your porch doesn't collapse or your business makes profits or you know, whatever it might be. But there's plentiful data out there to show that a little bit of attention and preventive maintenance goes a long way, right? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So that's step one, is just to get your facts straight. Step two, the second principle, is that maintenance depends on culture and management. And what we mean there is that, you know, maintenance on its own, people might sort of groan or it might not grab them. But the people who we interviewed in the book all made connections between maintenance and things that really get them motivated. So we interviewed a CEO who started a software company. They sell maintenance software, but maintenance for him and his employees means environmental sustainability. It means wasting less stuff, and it means preserving the environment, preserving the world for future generations. And so as managers, what we need to do is to tap into those deeper values that people hold and connect maintenance to that. And it's usually just a matter of asking people the question that you started with, you know, what do you care about? What's important to you? What's worth preserving? So maintenance sustains success. Maintenance depends on culture and management. And the third principle is that maintenance requires constant care. Mm. We've touched on that already. There's no fix it and forget it with maintenance. You know, there might be a big project, but eventually anything will need more care. And so it's that attitude of attention towards preservation and an openness towards solutions that will help. And sometimes those solutions come, you know, are packaged as innovative things or new technologies. And so in the book, we talked to some companies that have predictive analytics software. They use artificial intelligence, remote sensors, and their technologies and their approach helps their clients, say, like a hospital that has emergency rooms that need their air handlers to work. And so, you know, high technology is really effective. New technology is really effective for helping them meet those ends. So, you know, that's the kind of three-step process that we spell out that is effective for business, but also individuals. And, you know, if our elected officials grasp onto this, we think it could be effective for them too. Mm.
I really like how you mentioned the connection to values, because there was a section where you write about maintenance and the connection to collective values. And that was just a very mind-blowing section to think about, of just how much our collective values are overshadowed by our individual values sometimes.
This is where it's helpful to look to other cultures sometimes, you know, like the way high-speed trains are maintained in Japan, where there's, you know, I think it's like, you know, their delay time is like under a minute for their, you know, on an annual level, the average delay is like under a minute, you know, and you tell that to people on like the Acela corridor on the East Coast, and like, they'll probably just fall to their knees in tears, you know. Or, you know, like the Dutch are famous for, you know, their dikes and control of the ocean. And so after Hurricane Katrina happened, and, you know, in the face of rising sea levels from climate change, like Dutch expertise has spread around the world. So I think that this is like, you know, this is like one of those, when kind of comparison to other cultures is a good reminder for like US individualists who maybe need, some reminder that there's more to it than just us as individuals.
Mm. I also like that, Andy, you mentioned that, you know, we can learn, especially from a political nature, a lot from maintenance. So how does a maintenance mindset go beyond partisan politics and really unlock the things that we need to get done?
I think part of it is that, for better or worse, maintenance hasn't really been in the political crosshairs. So it's not one of these subjects that's already been beaten to death and people are entrenched in whatever they believe and have no interest in changing their beliefs. But I think really, you know, a lot of people have a lot of things simply that they want to preserve that are important to them, and they don't fall into typical political categories. The epilogue of the book, we start just profiling a few of the people who we've met along the way, and they include a Marxist union organizer, someone who was really active in Occupy Wall Street, and then two conservatives and religious conservatives who all really support maintenance and conservation in different ways, you know, whether it's software, city planning, rural life, or community organizing. It really resonates with a lot of different audiences. We didn't predict that, but now that we've just talked to people about it, it makes a lot of sense that a lot of different people can claim this cause as something that supports their values.
Yeah, I think there's interesting intersections too. I agree with everything Andy just said, but you know, like, so Chuck Marone of Strong Towns is one of the people we highlight in that part of the book on kind of bipartisanship. You know, he's a conservative Catholic with like a libertarian bent from northern Minnesota, you know, from the middle of nowhere kind of. And yet you can be a liberal, like modern monetary theorist who thinks we need to spend way more money on a federal level and still realize the truth of what Chuck says, which is that there's no way to just kind of like spend ourselves out of a hole when we dig ourselves in too deep by just taking on more and more infrastructural debt. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that there's ways that we can listen to each other, even if there's, you know, parts of the policies we're not going to agree on. There's mm-hmm. still a kind of like shared middle ground we can find to talk and think around.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, speaking of partisan politics, one of the things that I was thinking about as I was reading the book was the amount of innovation speak around vaccine development for COVID.
Oh, God.
It just seems like if we just say the right words, we can change what it actually takes to make something.
Yeah, at an industrial scale, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that is not simple.
No, and it's just fascinating. So, like, how can an understanding, I think, from... I mean, we can maybe not hope societal level, but individually, how can we have a better understanding of innovation, true innovation and maintenance to allow us to have realistic expectations?
You know, I would plug our book, I guess.
Well done.
I would say, you know, I think this is where Andy and I can also speak up for our field, you know. I would recommend people look at books like The Shock of the Old by David Edgerton and More Work for Mother by Ruth Schwartz Cowan. You know, the history of technology is just so good at getting at especially the history of the last 150 to 200 years of industrial culture. Mm-hmm. And just helps us see the ordinary processes of including like standards and the roles that that has played in creating incremental improvements that really add up over time. Mm. And I really, you know, this is how I teach my classes. I teach classes about innovation and technological change. And I try to emphasize those themes in order to, you know, it's like a vaccine, you know, it's a mental vaccine against just kind of BS in our culture.
Yeah.
The way we think about technology is to like educate yourself about how technological change has actually worked over the last 200 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I have been encouraged in some of the reporting. Maybe my brain just filters out the innovation speak just to keep myself sane. But, you know, some of the reporting, the recognition first that essential workers make and non-pharmacological interventions like masks and social distancing, you know, those are small routine acts that people need to take to maintain their health while we wait for this, you know, magic technological fix in the form of vaccine to put us back to normal, I suppose. But even some of the reporting around vaccines has been really helpful, and testing. So whether it's the reagents that labs need and shortages of those reagents that labs need to run effective tests, the materials that the labs and pharmaceutical companies need to move all of these specimens back and forth, and the PPE as well. I was just reading something today about the cold storage chain. So let's say you've got hundreds of millions of doses of vaccine. They need to be kept at a certain temperature. And that's a supply chain issue. That narratives about, you know, scientists in a lab coming up with this great new innovation, you know, it falls totally outside that narrative. But I think there's a recognition that, and I hope it's a widespread recognition, that it's these little incremental attention to detail things that are going to make the difference in actually getting any vaccine to people who need it.
The fact that, I mean, you just blew my mind thinking about the supply chain of like distributing cold storage. I mean, oh my gosh, my brain is just swimming. Whoa.
It'd be nice if just, you know, the scientists could make the right formula in a lab and poof, it goes to, you know, however many billion people we have, but
we can't push it like an update to the app store. What?
Yeah. And the other thing, you know, to keep in mind is you know, people kind of use innovation speak around the vaccine story, but the only reason we can respond to COVID in this way and have hopes that, you know, a vaccine will emerge in the next couple months is because people do this day in and day out. Mm-hmm. And I bet there are standards around vaccines that we could find if we looked into it that have been developed over the last 50 years. And it's only because we have kind of an industrial process and supply chain around this that we can respond in this way. You know, we're not creating this from scratch.
Yeah.
There is capacity there that's been built up for generations. And that's the key. You know, that's the thing we need to pay attention to.
Absolutely. It's not like there's going to be this person showing up with a cooler.
You know, yeah, like Tony Stark or whatever, right? Exactly. You're just like Iron Man comes down from the sky. It's not like that, you know? Like, there is no person. It's like an entire teams upon teams of people that are going to make this happen.
That's awesome. Well, one of the things that I love talking to people about, especially co-creators, is what it was like to work together. And so what was it like to write the book together as co-writers?
It was great.
Yeah, it was fun.
I mean, Andy and I are lucky. We're old friends. Mm-hmm. We met each other when I was checking out grad schools and became pretty quick friends through our professional society, which is the Society for the History of Technology. And we worked together at Stevens Institute of Technology. That's where all this started. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I would say, just in terms of writing, is that we had quite a bit of experience writing shorter pieces together. Okay. So our essay, Hail the Maintainers, and some other stuff we did early. So we kind of like had built up a process for how to handle writing together. Mm-hmm. What were you going to say, Andy?
Some of that, you know, the fact that we weren't just starting from scratch, and that we were, you know, friends first and foremost, but then on this journey to get this message out to broader audiences than historians of technology typically try and reach. The other thing that was a lot of fun was we did a couple writing retreats where we scooted off to the mountains of Virginia and found a cabin for the weekend. And since we live, you know, 6 or 7 hours apart, a lot of this was, you know, using Dropbox and that sort of thing. But to be able to hang out together, to spend that extra time, have some fun, goof around, make some, you know, grill some food was a really important, I think, point. And came at a crucial point in the book for a few different things. Mm. And our last retreat was a virtual retreat just because time was tight. We couldn't quite get out of our respective areas. But that was a major thing that made a lot of fun.
That's cool. It's awesome that you started as friends. That probably helps when the inevitable disagreement comes up. And so I'm not gonna point any fingers or call anyone out. But how did you actually work through disagreements?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there were disagreements, but we are friends first and foremost. So it just, you know, we would just go back to that, you know, we really love each other. And, you know, nothing is going, we're not going to let anything get in the way of that, you know, whether it's workload or money or, you know, we will throw all that away to make sure the friendship stays intact. So I think that's really what it came down to for us.
That's awesome. I think I'm just going to take that snippet and throw everything else away. No, I'm just kidding. Because it's just like, that's what we want to hear. We want to hear that, you know what, we work through these issues. We enjoy what we do. We enjoy working together and we create something that we're proud of. I mean, that's awesome.
And, you know, and we had a lot of help too. So we had a really talented editor at Currency, Derek Reed, who ruthlessly cut a lot of the first draft and helped us really focus on areas where we needed it. Our agent, Lauren Sharp, really, you know, when I think back to some of the first drafts we sent her of the proposal, she really helped us with voice and framing. She's a really gifted writer and editor herself. So I think all creators know, but I don't know if we talk about it enough, that it's not just the lone genius or a couple of the guys whose names are on the front of the book. We're not the only ones who made the book, you know? We get the credit, but the copy editor, it was saved us
awesome.
from numerous mistakes, you know, all throughout. And then our network of friends, scholars who are experts in anything from Edison to housework, you know, saved us too. So it's a big team effort.
So now that you've gotten this book done, what's next? What are you using this momentum to do next?
You know, there's like different ways you can end a book like this. We could have had like a bullet, you know, a list of bullet point policy recommendations we had or something like that. And, you know, we decided that that was not the honest way for us to end this book. That's not like the note we wanted to end on. And so we end the book with inviting people to a conversation with us. And we're with Jessica Meyerson. We were running this group called The Maintainers, where we hope to continue discussions and working through issues about how to improve both maintenance and give more attention to maintainers over the coming years. So we really encourage people to get a hold of us. They can go to themaintainers.org and sign up for our email listserv is really the best way to stay in touch, or just drop us emails. In a sense, like, I think, you know, my hope is that the book is like a culmination of the first moment of the maintainers. It's kind of the statement and the invitation. And now, like, the hard work begins of how we connect to people and how we get into organizations and, you know, how we talk to policymakers and how we think through to make like really lasting change together.
Yeah, because maintenance, it's not sexy sometimes.
Definitely not.
No, but it's not going away either. So, you know, that's, we joke sometimes that we've picked this topic that's always going to be timely. And we would love for people to look at some of the problems that we've identified and say, well, we solved that, you know, and that would be wonderful, but it takes constant work, really hard work. So the more this message resonates with people and they take it and make it their own, whether it's in their personal lives or at work or thinking about, you know, who they're going to vote for, I think the better off we'll all be.
Well, you both mentioned some books earlier, but I'm curious what book, podcast, or resources kind of blow in your mind right now.
Andy, what do you got?
I've been reading about vaccines. So one of my mentors in grad school, Lou Galambos, wrote a book about vaccine development at Merck. That's a great book. It's called Networks of Innovation. He's a believer in innovation, as are we, but we, you know, have I guess different points of view on it. That's a good one. And then another one that really blew my mind was, I think it's called Outbreak by Tim Litton. And it starts with a story about how some cantaloupe farm, it's a standard story, cantaloupes, led to an outbreak that killed a few people because of holes in the, enforcement system about some regulations of cantaloupe storage. Wow. So, it's a great book.
I've been reading, Adam Tooze's big book Crashed, which is a history of the 2008 financial crisis. And I interviewed Tuz recently, and I think the interview will be up on YouTube soon. He's become kind of a major voice and analyst around our moment, the COVID-19 moment, mm-hmm. just because there's so many kind of financial and economic big questions in the air. And, you know, he's an expert on the last crisis and previous crises too. So he's a really interesting voice to listen to.
Fantastic. Well, Andy and Lee, thank you so much for taking time and being on Getting Work to Work. I really enjoyed reading your book, but I enjoyed this conversation that much more. Thank you both.
Thanks for having us. This is great.
Thank you.
I certainly learned a lot from The Innovation Delusion by Lee and Andy, and I hope you'll add it to your reading list. Regardless, take the time to consider the maintenance question. When you add new equipment or technology to your business, or even upgrading something in your home, I know for myself, I don't think about it until it's too late. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.